I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea. I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today we're going to be talking, well, really continuing the conversation that we've started on the Declaration of Independence and its legacy. And particularly today we're going to be talking about the American Revolution and the fate of the world. It's a great title for a great book by our guest today, Professor Richard Bell. For those of you who don't know, Rick teaches history as a professor of history at the University of Maryland, where he teaches, of course, courses in American history. He is a widely published author, besides this terrific new book, The American Revolution and the Fate of the World. Got another great one that came out in 2018 called Stolen, Five Free Boys Kidnapped into Slavery and Their Astonishing Odyssey Home. Really a very interesting work on American slavery and the vexed position of freed African Americans in the 19th century. So I want to recommend that book, but of course today we're going to be talking about this book, The American Revolution and the Fate of the World. Rick has also been a National Endowment for the Humanities public scholar, and won that award, and is just you have to read his books to understand that academics can write really engrossing history. It's possible. To our listeners, let me recommend the book we're talking about today. Rick, thanks for being with us on The American Idea.
Jeff, it's my pleasure.
The book, it is an interesting title. I love the title, but it's an interesting one, The American Revolution and the Fate of the World. I think there's been some, when we think about sort of America 250, we think about it, at least as Americans, from an American point of view, and maybe we even think that, well, the American Revolution was just a sideshow in the larger history of the world, particularly European history. You challenge that argument in your book. You challenge that view and encourage us to think more broadly about the American Revolution. What's your argument in the book against someone who would say the American Revolution was just a parochial affair on the eastern seaboard of North America?
Yeah, I'd say that's dead wrong, of course. I'd say it's an important event in global history. I think it's a geopolitical earthquake in lots of ways. In fact, that phrase in my book title, The American Revolution and the Fate of the World, that's lifting a quote from Jefferson. Jefferson is talking in 1826 about the 50 years of impact of the Declaration of Independence. And he says it proved to be an instrument pregnant with the fate of the world. He's talking about that document, but the larger event from which that document emerges, the American Revolutionary War, is an event that sucks in people from across the world to participate in some of the fighting here in North America. I think of Baron von Steuben, the Marquis de Lafayette, et cetera, et cetera. But it's also an event that ripples out from the 13 rebel colonies, so that it's actually a world war in all but name. There's fighting around the world as part of the American Revolution, in the Mediterranean Sea, in the North Sea, in the Caribbean, in Nicaragua, in Belize, in Honduras, in Quebec, in Cape Town, in Cape Verde, in India, right? This is no more or less a world war than the Seven Years' War that preceded it and the Napoleonic Wars that will follow it. And I would also say it had global consequences as well, as America rises, but also as other empires are sort of shaken by what the Patriots have been up to in North America, a global story.
Tell us a little bit about this. Bring us back for our listeners to the 1760s, 1770s, the situation of the British Empire, because, of course, North America, the United States is not the United States, it's British North America at the time. What is its situation within the larger British Empire?
So we could say a couple of things. The first one is to say that the British Empire in 1775 looks different than the British Empire in 1875, or even 1975, of course, as well. So the British do have a toehold in India. They have three major settlements in India, Madras, Calcutta, Bombay. They have 12 slave forts in West Africa. They have Ireland, which they've treated like a colony for centuries, even though technically it's a kingdom. They've just taken control of Canada from the French in the previous global war, the Seven Years' War, and they've been expanding their footprint in the Caribbean by taking strongholds from France and Spain and the Netherlands, and then those 13 mainland colonies that run from Georgia up to New Hampshire, because Vermont doesn't exist yet. There's also two Florida colonies, which are in British hands. So there are, depending on how you count, Jeff, about 25 to 30 British colonies in North America and the Caribbean. And of course, 13 of those, just about half, will break away by 1776, 1777 or so. So it's a fragmented picture, right? Because the other colonies in British North America and the Caribbean do not secede at the same time. So that sets up interesting questions about why does the Caribbean go one way, but the mainland go another way? Why doesn't Canada break away? And also makes us think about the relative value of some of these different British colonies for Britain itself. Students often ask me, which was the most valuable British colony in 1776? And depending on what their home state is, they hope I'm going to name whatever home state.
Of course.
If they're from Virginia, surely Virginia must be the most valuable. If they're from, New York, surely New York was the most valuable. And the answer is the most valuable British colony in the New World in 1776 is Jamaica, 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 Jamaica. So that means Britain has difficult decisions to make, especially when France enters the war and starts threatening Jamaica and other really valuable Caribbean holdings, which is one reason the Patriots are desperate to get the French and the Spanish into the war, because it's going to draw British fire away from the mainland and direct it to wherever the French and Spanish navies are on the offensive.
Of course, and North America itself, you mentioned Canada and the British taking possession of Canada after the Seven Years' War. Canada seems to have been on the minds of a lot of the American revolutionaries.
Yeah, that's certainly true.
Yeah, talk about the position of Canada and the impact of the revolution and its place sort of in revolutionary thinking.
So we can say that Canada is a new British possession, but anyone can see how big it is, right? In fact, the British take over the French colony of Quebec, which back then had borders encompassing basically most of the Midwest as well. So places like Ohio used to be Quebec, for instance. So Quebec was a major prize for the British. And when the 13 rebel colonies are trying to expand their coalition to bring in other British colonies, they reach out to East Florida, they reach out to West Florida, they reach out to Jamaica and Barbados, and they reach out to Quebec as well, hoping that they're going to expand from 13 rebel colonies to 14, 15, 16, 20, whatever it might actually be. In fact, in 1776, Jeff, they send their best man, Benjamin Franklin, up to try to persuade the French Quebecois still living in what used to be French Canada, but now British Canada, to rise up against the British, and the Quebecois say thanks, but no thanks. There's actually two failed invasions of British Canada in the American Revolution. One of them led by Benedict Arnold back when he was still a patriot commander. So they're constantly trying to expand the chessboard, expand the territorial footprint of the rebellion, hoping that the more places insurrection bubbles up, the harder it will be for the British government to play whack-a-mole and knock down all those insurrections at once.
You mentioned, of course, the French entering the war. I think we have the treaty in 1778, yep. And then the French. It's interesting that the French, and of course, I'm sure students ask you, you have a monarchy joining an alliance with a nascent republic, early little small republics. Why do the French join with the Americans?
That's a great question, right? So I think there's still the view that the French are doing it because they believe in the same things the Patriots do, right? That they're in love with the cause. And when we make that argument, we're really thinking of the Marquis de Lafayette, a young French aristocrat who is in love with the Patriot cause, who is deeply ideologically sympathetic. That's why he goes and volunteers in George Washington's army and puts on a Patriot uniform. But that's not what King Louis does, and that's not what his prime minister, the Comte de Vergennes, the smartest man in Europe, does either. They're not in love with the cause. They're not anti-imperialists. They're not anti-monarchists, right? They don't believe that all men are created equal. That would be wild if the French king, who thought that. So we shouldn't jump to the conclusion that the French reasons to jump in are the same as George Washington's reasons to jump in, of course. The French court takes its sweet time formalizing a military alliance. As you said, 1778, when the war begins almost 3 years earlier at Lexington and Concord in 1775. So France only gets in when France is good and ready, knowing that it will draw the military attention of Great Britain as soon as it officially allies with the Patriots. And so France is spending several years in an internal argument about whether getting in on the Patriot side is wise or not, because they and the Patriots have only one thing in common, and that is their mutual disregard for King George and for Britain at that time. These Protestant insurrectionists don't have much in common with a Catholic king, as you pointed out in your question. So it has to be worth it for France. And what does worth it mean? France doesn't go in with the intention of grabbing territory from Britain in North America. It's not actually trying to take back Canada. It thinks that ship has largely sailed. It's instead trying to watch the British Empire disintegrate, to encourage its disintegration, to knock King George down several pegs, and in so doing, raise up the new king, King Louis XVI of France, a young king eager to make his mark. The French foreign minister, the Comte de Vergennes, is also at the start of his career, eager to make an impact. And they think cutting Britain down to size, even if the US is the beneficiary rather than France in terms of territory, is worth it. And in fact, in terms of worth it, you could even put that in economic terms, Jeff. And we know that the French finance minister, a guy called Necker, and the foreign minister, Vergennes, go back and forth over whether spending all this money to prop up the Patriots is a good ROI, a good return on investment for the French government. And Necker says, no, we're throwing good money after bad. We're already in debt. Why would we do this? And Vergennes says, no. If we spend money now while Britain's fighting itself, it will be cheaper than fighting Britain when Britain is strong 5 years from now, 10 years from now. And Vergennes wins the day. And it's that internal argument's resolution that in part explains the timing in 1778. The other part of this is France has been rebuilding its navy, which has been decimated by Britain in the last war, and it takes until 1778 for France to complete that multi-year rebuilding program.
And what about French strategic interests in the Caribbean? Is that part of their overall strategic thinking?
Yeah, I think it is. So I said, when it comes to Canada, I think that ship has sailed. They don't seriously expect to get Canada back under French command. But that's a different ball of wax when it comes to British possessions in the Caribbean. Islands are much easier to conquer and take and hold in war than a massive territory like Quebec, for instance, if you don't already have a foothold in North America. And so both the French and the Spanish, Jeff, think that they have a chance to take back French and Spanish sugar islands that Britain's captured in the previous war, the Seven Years' War. Spain's actually the best example here. They're desperate to take back Jamaica, which 100 years plus was a Spanish island, and Spain has not forgotten that. And any chance they can get to take one of Britain's roughly 13 Caribbean colonies is basically like capturing a money factory, like capturing the US Mint. Jamaica is a money printing factory, and whoever holds it has a huge economic advantage in Europe. So, yeah, they definitely have their eyes set on the Caribbean, as you say.
Spanish interests themselves, do they go beyond the Caribbean? What, Spanish Florida, territory in Europe. What's their strategic thinking about this engagement and whether they're going to go in on the Patriot side or not?
Yeah, they share some of the same reticence about getting in right away as the French do, but they also see some of the same opportunities that senior ministers in France do. And Florida Blanca, who is the prime minister of Spain at the time, is, yes, certainly interested in taking back lost territory from the British Caribbean and putting it back under the Spanish flag, shoring up control over Cuba as well. But he's also interested in Europe. Many of your listeners may have heard of Gibraltar, this rocky outcrop on Spain's southern tip, which basically guards the gates of the Mediterranean. Whoever goes in or out of the Mediterranean has to sail right past Gibraltar. There's only a very slim, I think, 12-mile shipping channel between Gibraltar and North Africa. And Britain has held Gibraltar, has been occupying Spain's front door since about 1704, and there is nothing in the world the Spanish king wants more than to get Britain off its front porch and to get Spanish control of Gibraltar. So when Spain agrees to get in and ally with France against Britain, and France is already allied with George Washington, Spain has conditions, and the conditions are that French military leaders have to support Spanish war aims in two particular ways. One is by contributing soldiers, sailors, and ships to a joint siege of British Gibraltar, and the other is to contributing soldiers, sailors, and ships to a joint invasion of southern Britain, a sort of blitzkrieg designed to, you know, sow chaos in Britain itself and ruin civilian morale. So Spain tries both of those things, invading Britain and laying siege to Gibraltar, contributing huge numbers of Spanish military personnel in hopes of making big gains, and sadly for Spain, fails on both counts.
The another part, of course, of the international story of the American Revolution, and of course alluded, mentioned, and discussed in your book, is on the one hand we have French and Spanish military forces, particularly naval forces. We also see, even in a miniseries like the HBO miniseries John Adams, where he has to go to the Netherlands because we might need British and we might need French ships, we might need Spanish military support, but we need Dutch money, apparently. Yeah.
That's right, yeah. So the Dutch are all over my book. They don't get their own chapter, but they're sprinkled throughout, right, which reflects the sort of inchoate ways in which the Dutch did influence the American Revolution. Militarily, they're very late additions. They only sign a treaty of alliance with France and Spain in 1780, the last major European power to join the anti-British coalition. But as you suggest, you know, John Adams has been lurking around the Netherlands for a while, trying to get more and more loans. They're technically they're loans, like they might be paid back, but everyone understands they're basically grants, right? They're never going to be paid back. And we can say that whether we're talking about the Netherlands or France or Spain, there's always a covert supply chain story to talk about. Even before these three military powers weighed in, France and Spain and the Netherlands are offering sweetheart trading deals to buy basically guns and ammo at like wholesale or below market prices. And the Netherlands is a great example of this. Jeff, they open their arsenal in the Caribbean, a little rock called Saint Eustatius, up to Patriot traders. And Patriot traders go there like it's Sam's Club or Costco, and they're buying massive amounts of guns and ammo at deep discounts, oftentimes on IOUs that will never be paid back. So much so that, according to one scholar, 40% of ships arriving in Baltimore and Philly during the war are cargo ships coming from this tiny Dutch island that no one's ever heard of, and they're full of guns and ammo being sourced basically by the Netherlands. Yeah.
Does this, as the war moves on, and you have France joining, you have Spain's involvement, the Dutch funding in particular, what's the reaction in Britain? Is there alarm? Does this create party division? Yeah. Because or do they see this as essentially irrelevant to the struggle that's happening in front of them in North America.
Definitely not irrelevant. No, I think alarm, a predictable sense of outrage, right? It's not a surprise that France and Spain, Britain's greatest enemies over the last 300 years, take this opportunity, the opportunity of a lifetime for France and Spain, to wade in and help the British Empire destroy itself, right? That's, of course, in Spanish and French. Interest. So this is in some ways entirely predictable, which is one reason why the Royal Navy is building furiously itself during these years, because it fully anticipates it will be fighting the French Navy and the Spanish Navy in due course. Nonetheless, when those military alliances are signed in 1778 for France and 1779 for Spain, it does mean battle stations, because it brings the war into Europe in a much more direct way than even Patriot privateers had been able to do. Because with no disrespect to John Paul Jones, the Continental Navy really isn't a significant factor in this, whereas the French Navy is, the Spanish Navy is. As I said a moment ago, France and Spain will gang up and invade Britain, or try to invade Britain, in 1779. Imagine what that's like on the home front, right? Everyone is losing their minds in southern Britain. So in the one sense, it's battle stations and it's panic. But in another way, it's a huge boost to British morale. Now, that sounds very counterintuitive based on what
it does.
I just said.
Explain that.
But remember, up until 1778, Britain has been fighting British subjects in North America. The Patriots are all British subjects. They're fellow Britons, just like, you know, anyone in Britain itself. And that's caused a lot of unease, a lot of second guessing in Britain itself as to why are we beating up our own people or trying to put them under their boot? That's my cousin. That's my uncle. Why are you doing this, King George? This seems like a terrible plan. It's not been a very popular war, Jeff. But wait till Catholic France joins in the fight against Protestant Britain, and then Britain and France go back to their old dynamics, and there is nothing more boosterish for civilian morale than the chance to take the fight to France, the chance to take the fight to Spain. And ironically, it becomes a sort of religious war, right? The Protestant way of life under threat from the Catholic heresy, right? That's how it's framed by British propagandists. So even though it's a disaster militarily for Britain when these two great powers wade in terms of morale and recruitment, it's a shot in the arm in 1778 and 9.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
What effect does it have, the Spanish and French engagement militarily joining? What effect does it have on the actual battles in North America? Does it lead the British? Does it distract the British? Does it give the Patriots some breathing space? Or what effect does it have?
Yeah, it has a really important effects, right, which we've sort of minimized or written out because we're often focused solely on those battles on the mainland. And we don't see the opportunity cost and decision making that British commanders have to go through to decide where to put their resources once France and Spain and eventually the Netherlands weighed in. So a great example would be Philadelphia. Philadelphia is the capital of the rebellion. Think of the Continental Congress, right? And Britain captures it. The Redcoats capture it in, I think, 1777. It's a huge morale boost for the British Army in America. They've seized the rebel capital. We've got this in hand. And then about 6 months later, France joins the war in the spring of 1778 and immediately sends all its navy ships to go raid British Jamaica and other British Caribbean posts. So all the navy ships that in peacetime might have been protecting Jamaica from any potential threat, they've all long since left Jamaica to go up to the East Coast, right, to bombard, you know, Norfolk, Virginia, or somewhere in Connecticut or whatever else. And so they immediately have to redeploy back to the Caribbean. It's like the keeper in a soccer game coming out of the goal too far and then having to run backwards. This is the only soccer analogy I'll ever use because I don't know sports. And they also have to, Britain also has to send troops down to garrison Jamaica from the French attack. Where does it get those troops from? Philadelphia. It has to surrender Philadelphia, basically walk out of there and say you can have it back, because it would rather send those troops and those ships down to Jamaica to ring fence Jamaica. So that's a critical advantage for George Washington, which is why he wants France and Spain in the war. And then the most famous example of the critical additive value is Yorktown, of course. We think of Yorktown as a land siege, which in part it is. And most of us do know that the French army is present under Rochambeau. We may be less clear that the French navy is also there, and the French navy have held the coast around Yorktown so that the Royal Navy can't come in and relieve Lord Cornwallis. And by holding the Royal Navy out to sea and at bay, actually beating them in the Battle of the Capes in September of 1781, it makes it harder and harder for Cornwallis to escape that pincer movement on land. So it's not just without the French army at Yorktown, it's without the French navy at Yorktown. Things could have come out quite different. Cornwallis is a formidable opponent.
Can you say a little bit more about the, you mentioned privateering and American privateering, and the effectiveness of American privateering, and if there's any connection with, for example, are they aided at all by the French Navy? Is there any actual tactical coordination, or is it the value of the French Navy in distracting the British Navy to make room for American privateers?
Yeah, so American privateers are hugely important, Patriot privateers. I have a whole chapter about them in the book. It's one of the chapters I think readers will find most fascinating, because it's just ordinary folks. I follow a guy who ends up on two privateering vessels who's a school teacher in Boston before the war, but all his students go off to war, so he has to go off to war too, because there's no one to teach. So he becomes a privateer, which you might think of as sort of being a Patriot-sponsored pirate, basically. And the goal of privateering cruises is to raid British merchant shipping, to not only inflict economic damage on Britain, but also to seize the spoils of all those merchant ships, right, for the Patriots' benefit. And we know that about 50,000 Patriots, often just, you know, school teachers and farmers, maybe sailors if they're lucky, engage in privateering cruises throughout the war, and they wreak absolute havoc on the high seas, capturing so many British merchant vessels that it effectively creates an anti-war sentiment among British merchants and manufacturers who want this war to end so these raids will stop. And they're politically powerful in Britain, so they're yelling at the king and they're yelling at Lord North, stop this stupid war, it's bad, bad, bad for business. And it's school teachers like my guy William Russell who helped to send that message. There's not explicit coordination of the sort you might be thinking of with them and the French Navy, but there's sort of under the table coordination, because France and later Spain open their Atlantic and Caribbean naval bases and repair docks to Patriot privateers. So they don't have to have just one base back in Connecticut. They can land anywhere. They can take on supplies. They can reprovision, which makes them better able to be hunters in the Caribbean and in the Atlantic waters themselves.
You mentioned Benjamin Franklin, and I'm thinking of that. We're talking now about military coordination and tactical coordination. What about diplomatic coordination? The diplomatic side of the American Revolution is not very well known, I think, and not often taught. Of course, it's an important part of your book. Tell us about the American diplomats who were engaged with the world during the American Revolution and how successful they were.
Such an important question. Yeah, and I should say, just to close the loop on privateers, one thing Franklin will do of many while he's in Europe is organize his own little privateering fleet of three ships where he personally tells them where to go and what to raid, right? Huh. So that's a whole other
Benjamin
story.
Franklin pirate.
Benjamin Franklin the Pirate, exactly. His ships are called something like the Black Prince, the Black Princess, and the Fear Not, if I remember correctly. So Franklin emerges in glimpses throughout my book, but the sum total of those glimpses convince me, and I mean no disrespect to George Washington when I say this, that Franklin is as important a figure in the Revolutionary War as George Washington. I'm not pulling Washington down, I'm raising Franklin up. There, because Franklin is executing the diplomatic necessities that make patriot military victory possible. Washington wants France in. Washington wants Spain in, and Franklin is Washington's instrument and Congress's instrument to achieve that. Franklin will spend 90 months in Europe. They send him as soon as they write the Declaration of Independence. He's on a ship within about 2 months afterwards. And that's in part a reminder, Jeff, that while the Declaration has many audiences and serves many purposes, one of those audiences and one of those purposes is as a letter of invitation to foreign courts to come over and join us. And Franklin will be the physical manifestation of that invitation. He's the one persuading Vergennes that he's making the right deal. He's the one coordinating with John Adams in the Netherlands and John Jay in Spain to keep that momentum flowing and to keep the flow of guns and ammo under the table flowing even before formal military alliances enacted. So, as you know, I see the diplomatic angle, what's happening with that team of rivals of John Jay, John Adams, and Ben Franklin in Europe as no less significant to Washington's extraordinary tenacity on the battlefield. Washington understands that the way to win is going to be the work of, you know, many hands in many lands.
I think some of our listeners would be fascinated to know, they know on land during the war, people like Thomas Jefferson narrowly escaped capture at a certain point. And a number, of course, signers of the Declaration, similar situations. But I wonder abroad as diplomats, Franklin, for example, is so important. Our listeners might be interested to know, do the British make attempts to actually capture or intercede with our diplomats? Or is that forbidden by the laws of nations and of diplomacy?
I certainly think, you know, Britain is well aware of not being caught doing underhanded things. Britain is trying, Jeff, to hold the moral high ground during this war, which is increasingly hard to do, right? And are refusing to let the patriots portray themselves as the good guys. And that means Britain actually stops short of doing some of the things you might think an all-out authoritarian regime like the one portrayed in the Declaration might actually do. You know, so they're not, you know, lynching people left, right, and center. In the run-up to the war, they do not censor many newspapers in the colonies. You might think maybe they should have done, but they actually don't. They believe that they are trying to show the world that they're better than their enemies, better than France, better than Spain, and in this case, better than the patriots. So what they do is they spy. They spy any chance they get. In fact, your listeners may be amused to learn that when Franklin was in France for 90 months, his American secretary was a British spy. Huh. And even more humorously, Franklin knew it the whole time.
Really?
as well. Yeah. So I think it's that sort of level. We also know, you know, that British ships intercept a lot of American military and diplomatic related voyages. In fact, my friend Emily Sneff, the great historian of the Declaration of Independence, who has a new book out in the spring, one of the things she discovered is that when the Continental Congress sends some printed copies of the Declaration to the French court on a ship bound for Bordeaux, the reason that those copies never arrive is because a British ship intercepts the ship carrying those copies, and the captain says, "Oh crap," and throws them over the side. So we have to wait months for replacements to arrive. Meanwhile, Silas Deane, the American envoy in Paris, is going, "Okay, didn't you guys declare independence? Where's the proof? Where's the proof?" And he doesn't know the proof is at the bottom of the ocean because of those British interceptions.
Of course, as the Declaration itself does say, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. And we know the word does get out in the Declaration, and it does have an effect on people like the Marquis de Lafayette. I know that's a little bit of an old story, but of course it's also part of the story that you tell. That the words and the patriot cause do attract people from around the world. Individuals sometimes with the support of their government, sometimes not. What about the story of those people who leave and come to the United States or in other ways aid the patriot cause?
Yeah, so Lafayette is the most familiar example of a sort of highly skilled volunteer European officer who goes to find George Washington and, you know, put their money where their mouth is, right? Fight on the line. But he's just the tip of the iceberg, really. I have a chapter focused on the key roles that volunteer Europeans play in George Washington's army. And I actually use Baron Steuben, the Prussian drill master, as my example here, in part because he's slightly less familiar and also more misunderstood than Lafayette. And it's not as clear that he is as in love with the cause as young 18-year-old Marquis de Lafayette, but he's certainly very keen for the paycheck, very keen for the warfighting opportunity, and very keen to prove himself, having been fired from the Prussian army for personal reasons, to show the world that they made a terrible mistake firing him from the Prussian army. And look what a difference maker he can be to a ragtag army under George Washington's command. And the attempt that Steuben leads under Washington's direction to Europeanize the army when it comes to drilling is indicative of the way that senior commanders in the Patriot leadership wanted to level up their fighting force. And by level up, they didn't mean teaching guerrilla tactics and hiding behind trees, as we sometimes think. They mean trying to get this relatively untrained and relatively ill-equipped and inexperienced new army that didn't exist 2 years ago to look and behave and have the same potency as any of the great armies of Europe. So they're actually recruiting, you know, European officers like Steuben, like Lafayette, like Casimir Pulaski, Thaddeus Kosciuszko. The list goes on and on and on to fill gaps of experience and knowledge in engineering and artillery, for instance, cavalry, and drilling that the Patriots don't have. So this is strategy, again, to level up and Europeanize. And I think it makes all the difference.
I mean, one of the things I appreciate so much about your wonderful book is how we Americans sometimes have forgotten the international character of the struggle. And you've spent obviously a lot of time with the primary sources. You've spent a lot of time thinking and rethinking through. Maybe it's not a fair question, but I'm always curious to know what, you know, this period and you so well, when you're writing this book and you're doing all this interesting research, what's the most surprising thing to you?
Wow, that is hard, right? Because I've been reading a lot of great works of scholarship by other historians who've spent decades digging into one niche or another. And then I get to sort of pull together all those different strands of research and try to say something new and original to me. You know, I will say that in addition to the great stories about William Russell, this school teacher turned privateer who gets captured, sadly, and ends up in this awful POW camp in Britain, I was also struck by the story of Harry Washington, which came to my attention through the work of an Australian scholar, but I don't think is a story many Americans know. Harry was mentioned twice, very briefly, in the Ken Burns documentary recently, but deserves a whole movie. He should be the star of the show. Harry Washington was a black man enslaved by George Washington at Mount Vernon before the war. He was a stable hand there. Like many black men, he fled to the British Army during the war when Britain began promising lifelong freedom to enslaved men as a chaos strategy to disrupt the Patriots in the South. And Harry is hoping Britain will win the war and guarantee his lifelong freedom. They, of course, don't win the war. They lose badly. And Harry is nonetheless able to persuade a military commander in New York, a British guy, to evacuate him and about 3,000 other black refugees to British Canada, to Nova Scotia. That turns out to be, yes, no longer slavery for Harry and people like him, but also not a post-racist paradise. British Canada is in many ways not that much better than where he's been trying to escape from. And so after 9 very disappointing years in British Canada as a free man who's treated like the scum of the earth, he is able to relocate with 1,200 other black refugees to Sierra Leone, a new British colony in West Africa, supposedly designed to be the post-racist paradise that Harry's always dreamed of. When he gets there, Jeff, he finds out the British haven't really done much to prepare the way, and it's definitely not a paradise for anyone. And by 1800, Harry Washington is leading an anti-British, anti-imperial independence movement to throw off British control over Sierra Leone, right? So it turns out that Harry and George weren't so different after all. I love that story. Where's the movie?
Yeah, fabulous. Well, look, it's a book that is itself tells a wonderful story. It's a book full of terrific stories for our listeners. Let me remind you again, it's Rick Bell's book, The American Revolution and the Fate of the World. You are going to love it. It's worth your time. It's worth your energy. You will learn something new and you will be delighted by the stories and the writing. Rick, thanks for being with us today on The American Idea.
My pleasure, Jeff.